The OatJet Business Show is your gateway to expert business advice and real-world success stories. Each week, a different leader in the business world will share their tips, insights, and lessons, offering you practical advice to navigate your entrepreneurial journey. Whether you have a business idea or are just starting out or looking to elevate your existing business, the OatJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Ensure you get these transformative conversations live on Thursdays at 6 p.m. or find the podcast at highfm.com. Let's build your business empire together.
Welcome, welcome. It's that time of the week again. It's Thursday evening. This is the OatJet Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and with us tonight is Alan Sweden. Welcome, Alan.
Hi, David. Thanks very much for having me here tonight.
Great. We're going to change things up a little bit. I normally start off with a business story, and we're going to change it around a little bit. I'm going to introduce Alan first, and then I'll go into the business story. And if you have any questions, you can message us on 061-895-1019, and I'll incorporate those questions as we go through the interview with Alan into what we're doing, so you can be involved as well if you have any burning questions on that. So first of all, who is Alan Sweden? He's the co-founder of October Health, which was formerly Panda. He's also a co-founder of Akeso Clinics, and he's a psychotherapist. So tonight I'm really looking forward to this conversation because our guest is someone who has not only built businesses, he's also built a lot of impact. In 1998, Alan practiced as a psychotherapist. Then in 2007, Alan co-founded a group of psychiatric hospitals together with Alon Aptiaka, who was also co-founded Internet Solutions in those days. And the business grew to 13 psychiatric hospitals with 900 beds and treated around 21,000 patients annually before being sold to Netcare in 2018. In 2021, he co-founded October Health, originally launched as Panda, with a bold vision to deliver mental health care at scale. This was co-founded together with another Alon, but this was Alon Litz, who was previously the MD of Uber South Africa. Today, the company operates in South Africa, the US, Canada, and they're looking to expand even further internationally. The business was inspired in part by a deeply personal story involving Alan's late brother, which gives the work in mental health real depth and authenticity. And in 2024, he founded Mammoth, an ambitious healthcare data platform focused on giving people access to their own medical information with privacy consent. The name says it all because it's a mammoth task he's taken on. This was developed together with Dr. Lisa Street. And then you'd think, well, where's the Alon here? So there's no Alon, but there's an Alan McPhailan. He also serves on the board of Growthpoint Health and also involved in Alex, which you'll let us know what that's about. And he sits on the Integrated Board of Psychology at the University of Pretoria. What stands out about Alan is not just the scale of what he's built, but how he thinks about partnership, raising capital, solving real problems, and staying value-driven in a complex and often pressured sector. So tonight, what we're going to do is we're going to explore his entrepreneurial journey, how to choose the right partners, how investors really think, what it takes to expand internationally, and the principles that guided him in building business and balance and profit with purpose. Alan, welcome to the show, as I said. Your partners have all been Alon Aptiaka, Alon Litz, Alan McPhailan. You're also an Alan. So when we come back, I want to ask you, do you need to be an L to be involved with business with you.
Probably.
But we'll get to the heart of the interview after the break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You're listening to the AutJet Business Show on 101.9 High FM. I'm David Zeidel, and we're about to have a discussion with Alan Sweden, who's a psychotherapist and co-founder of a couple of businesses. But before we get there, I'm going to start off with a business story. And the business story is called Delivering Happiness, the Zappos story. And they're doing the unexpected. Years ago, I picked up a book called Delivering Happiness, which was talking about the Zappos story, and they're very different. Because around the year 2000, and when online shopping was still in its infancy, most retailers focused on being cheap. But Zappos, the online store that sold shoes, took a completely different approach. They wanted to win by delivering unforgettable service. Most people who know where they have call centers focus on the people handling the call as quickly as possible, and they actually monitor the time, and if they can, they reward people for handling the customer as quick as possible. Zappos focused differently. Their call center staff weren't pushed to end calls quickly. In fact, I think they hold the world record for the longest single call, which you won't believe this, is over 10 hours with one person. In fact, when I read the book, and I can't remember exactly, I think they had two bathroom breaks during the call. They offered free shipping both ways. In other words, if you wanted to return it, it was free shipping. If they didn't have the shoes you wanted, the agent would actually look for it and then tell you where to go and buy it, even though it wasn't through them. And one night during a late night conversation with a customer, the customer asked, "Can you help me find somewhere to order some pizza from?" Now remember, Zappos doesn't sell pizza. But the lady went on, looked at the restaurants in the order, got the guy the numbers, and told him which ones were open. And you'd think this would be bad business sense. But the result is, in 2009, Zappos was sold to Amazon for $1.2 billion. And the business lesson is that you can be efficient and you can try to save rands in the short term, but are you looking at the long-term gain? By delighting customers, by creating loyalty, reputations, and stories that build your brand, you're ensuring long-term success. And if you think like little stories like the pizza story and somebody being on the line doesn't sell your business, Zappos isn't even operating in South Africa, and you've just heard their story. So, Alan, welcome, and we want to hear your story. So if we can start off, if you can go back a little bit and tell us, how did you get into psychology in the first place? And then we'll have a look at how did you get into the different businesses which expanded your approach to psychology rather than being one-on-one to one-to-many.
Okay, thanks. I mean, that's a great question to start off with. I actually had a girlfriend when I was in my teens who suffered with depression, and I remember feeling pretty helpless about being able to help her. And then at some point she became suicidal, and I hope it wasn't because of me, and landed up in a hospital. And one day I went to visit her, and she was, you know, just, she just seemed better. And I asked her what had happened, and she said that she had met this this psychologist, and, you know, she had really been able to talk through some of the things that had been bothering her for many years. And I just became completely intrigued with this profession that, you know, that especially could help kids. When I first started out, I really wanted to work with children and adolescents. But I became really intrigued with this profession that didn't really work with medication or anything, yet worked in a hospital environment that just through talking and listening could really make such a big difference. And I kind of really got the bug. And I started reading lots and lots of works of fiction around psychology. And my dream was to become a child psychologist. At that time, we actually lived in Canada. We were one of those families that had emigrated. And when we came back to South Africa, I finished my matric at King David. And I really wasn't sure what to do after that. And I wanted to study psychology, and I went to speak to someone, and they said, look, there's probably going to be about 1,000 people in your psychology 101 class, and about 8 of them will become psychologists. And I thought, my goodness, you know, those odds aren't great. And I kind of chickened out, and I went across the road to West Campus, and I studied a BCom. And but I always had this idea that I really wanted to become a psychologist. But I got my commerce degree and really wasn't sure what to do when I finished that degree. And so my late father at the time, was working for a company called Southern Life, which sold life insurance. And he got me involved in a course, in a Southern Life course. And I remember I went out. I was a bit of a hippie in those days, but my father bought me 4 suits. We went out, and it was the first suit that I'd ever worn other than maybe my bar mitzvah. And the first or second day, they showed us a motivational video. And the motivational video was about this tennis player who was born basically with one arm, and on the other arm he only had 3 fingers. And he always wanted to become a professional tennis player, and he actually rose to get to like number 300 in the world or something. And I walked out of that lecture, and the motivational lecture was really all about, you know, become the best life insurance salesman that you can be. But I thought, you know, if this guy could become a professional tennis coach, then a professional tennis player, I could become a psychologist. And I actually dropped out that day, put the suits back in the cupboard, went to my parents and said, look, I need to go back to varsity. I need to follow this, and I need to go back to varsity and study psychology. And they said, okay, good luck. So that's what happened.
So I find that fascinating. Like, I often hear the story of people who want to do something, they go off the so-called path, but then get drawn back into it. And your story is quite amazing. And we're going to pick up on that story after the break.
Okay.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Know the basic principle. Run, hide, call the CSO, or fight as a last resort if trained and unavoidable. Awareness saves seconds. Seconds save lives. The CSO, protecting Jewish life and the Jewish way of life. Save our number onto your phone. 086-18-0018.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You tuned in to 101.9 Chai FM. This is the AutJet Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we're busy talking to Alan Sweden. And Alan was sharing with us just before the break how he had a girlfriend who had depression, and Alan felt helpless, and then found out that a psychologist helped her and wanted to do the same thing. But then I think you said only 8 out of 1,000 people could qualify, become psychologists, and you chickened out. But then you went and listened, saw a video, a motivational video, and it drew you back. So did you go back and start studying from scratch?
Yeah, I did. I had done psychology 1. I went back. I did psychology. I think I'd done psychology 1 and 2. Then I went back and did psychology 3. And suddenly I found university quite easy, where I'd struggled through my commerce degree. I went straight into honors from that. And then I had to apply to become to do masters, because in South Africa to become a psychologist, you need to get a master's. I really wanted to do clinical psychology. In the year that I applied, which was 1995, maybe 1994 even, there were about 500 applicants, and I tried at WITS and I didn't get in. And then about 2 weeks later, I went to the University of Johannesburg, which was the Rand Afrikaans University back then. And there were, again, about maybe 500 or 600 applicants. And slowly but surely, I worked my way through the rounds, and I was just extremely fortunate And I got accepted into the course.
So just for those who don't understand, and I'm one of them, what's a clinical psychologist compared to other psychologists?
So let's say there's four different kind of psychology masters. There's industrial, where you get to work in organizations, in organizational design and behavior. There's educational, where you're really working with children with learning issues, and you're mostly working in schools. There's counseling, where you are doing a lot of counseling and actually a lot of psychotherapy, but you're not really allowed as a counseling psychologist to work with diagnoses. And the diagnoses are the clinical diagnoses like depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, addiction, all of those things. And in order to work with those issues, you need to become a clinical psychologist.
Okay. And so you studied that, and then you worked in that for, was it 7 or 8 years?
Yeah, so I qualified as a clinical psychologist in about 1998, and then I went to work at the Tara Children's Hospital, which was in at Tara Hospital and in Alex on the East Bank, and I did that for about 2 years. And then I wanted to branch out and get involved in private practice, and so I went into private practice, specializing very much in addiction. And there were only a few sort of male psychologists in those days, and only very few of us who worked also with addiction. It's a very hard thing to do in an outpatient environment, in other words, not in hospital. And I grew quite a nice practice, but I was always quite frustrated with, although I absolutely love psychotherapy and I've been a patient for many, many years. I love the process, and I enjoy being a therapist. But I felt a bit frustrated about sort of only having this practice. I felt like I wanted to be more part of a bigger world. And so I put some feelers out there and I thought to myself, you know, what else can I do? And in about 2004, I met these two brothers who owned a hospital called Crescent Clinic in Cape Town, the Finkelstein brothers. And they couldn't find anyone to run the addiction unit in a psychiatric hospital that they were setting up in Randburg. And as soon as I heard about it, I just knew this was the opportunity that I'd been waiting for. I just, sometimes in life, you know, maybe when I met my wife, Lucy, and maybe when I heard about this, I just knew that there were these two things that were just, these were the right things for me. And they gave me the opportunity, basically because they couldn't find anyone else, because I was quite young and inexperienced. And we set up that unit in October 2004, and it just seemed easy for me. I just understood, you know, how do I fill up this unit? What do I need to do? To kind of help people to get well inside of this very short space of time that I had with them.
Did the fact that you'd actually done a BCom beforehand, did that come into play as well?
Yeah, absolutely, and. It really did, because I understood how to run spreadsheets, and I understood the very basics of income statements and balance sheets and cash flow and understanding those things. So I was quite well set up, actually, to set up a business of psychology at the time.
So it's almost like you were guided to do the so-called wrong thing, but that came into play at a later stage. And so yeah. you set this up, and then what happened from there onwards?
Yeah, I mean, if I could just say very quickly, like I say to my own kids and, you know, maybe anybody who'll listen to me, that it's just not a straight line. Mm-hmm. I do encourage our own kids to, you know, to experiment and, you know, if they can afford to, and to make mistakes and to choose the wrong thing sometimes is not necessarily the wrong thing. So we set up this unit, and we had 12 beds inside of a 30-bed hospital, and they couldn't fill the other beds. Actually, had a 50-bed license, but they just couldn't fill it. And I understood why they couldn't fill it, and really the reason was that they were marketing towards patients. And I understood that the customers of a psychiatric hospital are not necessarily patients, although those are the people that use the services. It's the psychiatrists themselves, because it's the psychiatrists that choose whether or not to admit their patients into a particular hospital. And so because they couldn't make a success of it, they were going to sell it, and I hated the idea of them selling it. And so Alon, who I'd grown close to over the years, Alon Apteka, had just sold out of Internet Solutions. And I went to him and I said, let's do this thing together. I'd always wanted to be in business with Alon. I really respected the way he had built up his companies, and he'd been so entrepreneurial. And I said, let's do this together. And he actually owned a hotel called the Garden Route Game Lodge. And what we started to do was we started to think about this as, besides for it being clinical, as being a hotel kind of experience as well. And we started to run the spreadsheets and start to understand, how do we get to a point where we break even? How many patients do we need? And I started to really understand the business of running a hospital. And I knew that what we needed was we needed psychiatrists. And so I went around and I visited psychiatrist after psychiatrist after psychiatrist in Joburg, trying to convince them to move their practices.
So you wanted them to be part in the business
yes,
itself?
Okay. I wanted them. So when we started off at Crescent Clinic, when I started working there, there were two psychiatrists there in practice, and they were struggling to get more psychiatrists to come and join. And what I realized I needed to sell to the psychiatrist was I needed to say to them, you can be busier and you can do the work that you really love to do. And the work that you really love to do is to treat patients who have with the skills that you have and not manage all the other aspects that a psychiatric patient has, which is a family often in trauma, children, and all the other associated things. So what I did was I took the models that we had learned at Tara, which was this multidisciplinary model, because government can employ doctors and private sector can't, but I managed to find a way to get these multidisciplinary teams to work together so that psychiatrists, instead of managing 3 or 4 patients, could now manage 8 or 9 patients. So they were busier, they were doing the work that they loved, and their patients were actually getting better because they had access all the time to psychologists, occupational therapists, physiotherapists, and everyone else that they needed.
So if you've just tuned in and you're wondering who we're talking to, it's Alan Sweden, and he's a psychotherapist and started a couple of businesses, and he's sharing the first business that he created. And just two very important lessons, I think, that Alan mentioned is to understand that the person using the service might not be your customer. So you found out that the psychiatrists were the people you should market to so that you could get to your real customer. That was the first thing. And how do you persuade them to come in? You persuade them by giving them other benefits. So those are two very, very important things that you found out and turned this into a success.
Yeah.
And then it grew quite to, was it 13 different?
So when we started working, there were two psychiatrists. And then what I started doing with Alon was we started looking for areas within South Africa where there were lots of psychiatrists but no psychiatric hospitals. Because the third party that we had to really be concerned about were the medical aides. And the medical aides wanted their patients to go into psychiatric hospitals instead of going into general hospitals. So I knew I'd have their support. And so what we started to do is we started to look for these pockets where there were psychiatrists but no psychiatric hospital. And then we'd go and we'd buy a piece of land and we'd establish a hospital. And eventually we built 7 hospitals and we bought 5. And then we had Crescent Clinic as well. And we were working with about 220 psychiatrists out of the 400 psychiatrists that are in practice in South Africa. And we were admitting about 21,000 patients a year. And built up quite a business.
I mean, that's astounding to go from not being able to fill the 50 beds to 21,000 is incredible.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is, as you said, you got to know your market and know the players in the market, the medical aid and how the market operates. And then were you still practicing as a psychotherapist at the same time?
I did for about, I gave up my practice in 2012. I was too distracted. Mm. I was trying so hard to keep it both going, but I became distracted, and I was with a supervisor at the time, and she said to me, you need to make a decision, and you need to choose one or the other. And I was just so immersed in the business side of it that I went away from it.
And was that a hard decision for you to make?
It was very hard, but I carried on doing clinical work in the hospitals. So I did get a taste of that, but over time I had to give that up as well. It was a hard thing to give up, but I got a lot of joy from the business as well. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is there a lesson in that as well, that sometimes you can love something, but you got to let it go?
I think the lesson for me was that it was about sort of staying true to what I really wanted within myself. And I knew that being in private practice in and of itself, as meaningful as it was actually not enough for me as in terms of my personality. I'm quite extroverted. I like being involved in different things, and I needed to give something up. I couldn't have it both. Mm. Yeah.
And then talking about giving it up, then you actually went and sold that practice.
Yeah, what happened was in about 2015, 2016, there was a health market inquiry run by the Competition Tribunal into the cost of healthcare in South Africa. At the same time, the ANC were talking a lot about national health insurance and what would happen. And when they first launched national health insurance, they were very aggressive in terms of their timelines. And I got a bit spooked by those things. And I felt like we would be better placed to be part of a larger group. There were just some things that were happening in South Africa at the time. Electricity was going up, so much. Water was going up a lot. Wages were going up a lot. And at the same time, the medical schemes weren't growing, because this was 2008, 2009. After that, South Africa went into a bit of a decline. And so we weren't getting a lot of increases from the medical schemes. And so our margins were getting really badly squeezed. And I just realized we needed to be part of a bigger group. So we started to go out and look to see who would be interested in acquiring us. Immediately there was a cultural fit with Netcare. And they made us an offer, and it went pretty smoothly with Netcare, I would say that, but it took us about 18 months to get through the Competition Commission and then the Tribunal. Mm-hmm. And then I worked for Netcare.
And then you worked for Netcare for a while.
Yeah.
And then you founded something called October?
Yeah.
Although it wasn't called that in the beginning.
No, it was called Panda. So what happened is I worked for Netcare, and then I left, and then COVID hit, and really not much happened. And then I got a call out of the blue by a friend of mine, John T. Brosen, and he said he wanted to introduce me to a friend of his, which was Alon Litz. And Alon had just left Uber, and I wasn't doing too much at the time. I was restrained, actually, and my restraint had just ended, and I wanted to get back into healthcare. And John T. said, let me introduce you to Alon. And maybe that was another time in my life that I just thought, this is the right thing for me. It was a different Alon, but it was a very... And a different dynamic, but Alon's energy and his, so what he had done very basically is with Uber, he had matched a driver who wanted to offer a service with a user who needed the service. And what had happened during COVID and what I realized is that there was a massive need for mental health care, and that the way that it had always been done was never going to manage to match that demand. And I thought, if Alon and I can partner and I can leverage his incredible logistical skills and the way that he thinks about solving problems with my understanding of the psychology world and how, working with triage and all those kinds of things that I'd learned, we can put something pretty special together. And so we formed this company called Panda. And the reason why we changed the name was because when we wanted to launch into the US, there was another company called Panda Health. And so we couldn't keep we didn't want to have two names. So we changed it to October, which was to honor my late brother, Kevin, who unfortunately passed away as a consequence of illness in about 2003. But his birthday was in October. And also we launched October Health in October. So it was something, and Mental Health Day is in October. So we changed it to October. And really there, the idea was to scale mental health care and keep the quality. And that has moved a lot. It still has mental health at its core and in its DNA. But really what October Health is these days is it works with large employers who want to make sure that they have a very healthy, happy, and productive workforce. And so we do everything that we can to engage with employees to make sure that they have all the support that they need to grow within the business and to take care of themselves nutritionally, psychologically, financially, etc., so that they're productive.
So again, the focus, and I might be incorrect here, but is your focus that the user of the product is not the customer? In other words, you sell to the company, but the employees use it. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. So it's a B2B2E play, which is business to business to employee. And initially we started off as a direct B2C, business to consumer, but it's so our clients are the employers, but the people that use it really are the employees, although the employers themselves do get enormous benefits out of it through dashboards and through really being able to engage with their employees in a very different and very creative and dynamic way.
And you must be concerned if you, so your customer is the company, but the person using it is the employee, and on healthcare, it's quite a sensitive thing. Do you have an issue of what you're allowed to share with the company, and was that ever an issue?
Yeah, absolutely. So we it's anonymous. A lot of the engagement with the employees is anonymous, especially in the live sessions. We run 18 hours of live sessions a day, and employees who engage with that are able to remain completely anonymous. So we would never know who's joining what kind of group. But then there are some things that employees sort of want to be known, you know, that they actually want to break that that barrier and know who it is. And that's around things like rewards and about, recognition. And so there's a balance. Employees can stay anonymous if they choose to, but there are lots of times when they want to actually show what they're doing.
And so what do you do there? Is it something, do you need a psychologist on the other side? Is it a whole lot of people joining and a psychologist is having like a group session? Or is it watching videos? Or is it watching pre-recordings? How does it really operate?
So it's all of that. So if we work with a company that has, let's say 100 employees, normally the companies are much larger than that, we'll have about 80 of those 100 who will actually sign up. Our adoption rates are incredibly high.
That's amazing.
And then we'll have easily 75 to 80% of the people engaging with the app on a regular basis. And they engage in lots of different ways. So they can go into the live sessions. There's lots of content that they can download. There are AI-driven coaching courses. There are assessments. There's a nutritionist. There's an AI. There's a mental health companion. There's an AI-driven mental health coach. So it's really, it's almost everything that you need to engage either anonymously or in communities to make sure that you are healthy and that you're able to arrive at work ready. And, you know, what we try and do is reduce absenteeism, reduce presenteeism, and improve productivity and retention of that you stay in your job because you feel happy and you feel rewarded.
So now I understand the original name because it sounds like you pander to all their needs.
Well, exactly that, but it was spelled differently, of course. It was more black and white. Yeah.
Excellent. So I'm going to move from that onto your next thing, which is a mammoth task, and you'll explain to us why it's called mammoth, but we'll do that after the break.
Great.
The AltJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You're listening to the AltJet Business Show on 101.9 High FM, and we're busy talking to Alan Sweden. I'm David Zeidel, and I'm trying to ask some difficult questions, but Alan seems to have all the answers. So Alan took us through the different businesses that he started, how he got into psychology to start off with, and then took an off route somewhere else, did a bit of business, and it came together. And I can't remember the exact line that you used, Alan, but you said it's not a straight line. You got twists and turns in your career, and it's worth doing different things because it comes together. And all these businesses have had a similar thread through them, but all different. And for me, one of the things that I've noticed is whatever you're doing, you're kind of looking into the future, and you're making decisions based on what the future is. So when you started the clinics, the fact that you saw that government was getting involved in national health and it kind of spooked you a bit, you said, okay, we need to move somewhere else. And you move somewhere else. And now you're looking at something where, first of all, you're doing the October Health. And is that still ongoing? Are you still involved in that because you're doing something else as well? So are you involved in the two things at the same time?
I'm very involved in October. I would say I chat to Alon Litz probably at least every day, at least once, and then we meet once a week, and then I meet with the exco at least once a week, and then I meet with other members of the exco individually as well. So I love being part of that business, but they are incredibly They're younger than me, and they are incredibly dynamic, and they actually didn't need me on a day-to-day basis. Maybe they would argue with that, but I really felt like, you know, that in fact, one of the things that happened is I brought a legacy way of doing business. I brought a 2004 style way of doing business, which was, you know, bricks and mortar and working according to budgets and forecasts and this was a startup mentality. And a startup mentality is actually so different from a business that is, you know, really about revenues and efficiency and you know, those things. So I love being part of that business, but I'm not involved in it on a daily basis. And then in about 2023, I got involved in a company that wanted to disrupt the way that schools do their screenings, ears, eyes, and teeth. And that morphed into something quite different, where I realized there was this massive gap where I'd always known about the gap, but what happened is that in 2024, there was a company called Care Connect, and Care Connect was collecting health records on South Africans and aggregating them into one unified care record. And unfortunately, it closed down. It lost its backing of its founders, and it closed down. But I thought, what an incredible opportunity. And so we, instead of going into the schools and building up a database from these kids that we were screening, we actually went into a complete tech play where what we're trying to do is trying to give you, David, your healthcare records all in one place. Now, there are lots of ways. There are lots of places that your health records are kept. They'll be kept within Ampath and Lancet and Dis-Chem and Clicks and at your GP and at your specialists and at the hospitals that you might have visited and at the radiologists and et cetera, et cetera.
But they're all separate.
They're all separate. Right. And when people talk about the fragmented nature of South African healthcare, a lot of the time they're talking about that. There are other issues. There's a fee-for-service issue and there's not being able to employ doctors. So there are other issues that contribute towards this fragmentation of healthcare. But one of the issues that can be solved is information sitting in all these different data lakes all over the place. And Care Connect tried to bring that all together. But what we're able to do, which is a bit different from Care Connect, is we are a completely neutral player. We don't have our own data. And what we do with the consent of the patient is we are able to go and look for in all the different places where your healthcare lives, take all the different codes, the way that that data is kept, convert it into one particular code, put it into one place, and then present you with an electronic health record or a unified care record, which is your longitudinal record, and it will have things like, what are your chronic illnesses? What are your chronic medications? What are your allergies? Who's your next of kin? What is all your demographic data? And all the other information that you think should be all in one place, so that when you go to a doctor, you never have to fill out another form. And when you go to a new doctor, that you don't have to sit for 20 minutes and give them a full history. You'll be able to just send them your complete history.
I went to a doctor the other day for my knee and sat there for, as you said, 15 minutes filling out and asking the same thing. And I thought, like, I filled this out before. Why do I have to do it again? So who's the customer in that case? Am I paying you for that service? Is the doctor paying you? How do you monetize this?
It's a great question. And the truth is that this has not really been monetized elsewhere in the world. Where there are electronic health records elsewhere in the world, they generally run by governments or by regional governments or by very large hospital groups, because those hospital groups know that there's two things that they can get of benefit if they invest in this electronic health record. The one is they can improve care, and they can improve the efficiency, and they can improve the safety. And through that, they can get the users coming back, because it's a much more convenient and safe experience for the user. So there are lots of different benefits of having it, but it has not been done in a way that needs to be commercialized. And the way that me and Alan McFarlane and Lisa Street are thinking about it is, South Africa will spend about 360 billion rand this year in private healthcare. That's about 9.2 million people who are insured and another 5 or 6 million people who will dip in and out of the healthcare system when they can afford it. I want to make that healthcare system much more efficient and much safer. And what I want to do with that is I want to give you your records. I want to make sure that your doctors have those records every time they see you so that they can make better decisions at that point of care. I want to make sure when you go in for an admission to a hospital that the hospital has all your outpatient records. My own history is that I have a blood disorder. I clot. I'm the opposite of a hemophiliac. And when I didn't know that and I was admitted into a hospital that didn't know that either, there were catastrophic consequences of that because they just treated me like any other patient. But when they put a catheter into my heart clotted and stopped. Now, if they would have known that, I would have gone in the night before. They would have treated me differently. So hospitals can really benefit from this, having this kind of information. And if I had forgotten to give that information because I hadn't thought of it for 20 years, they wouldn't know that about me. So I want to put all that information into the right hands. And I feel like I will find ways of making this a sustainable, commercially viable business because there's too many people who would gain from it. But if I sat here and told you that I had all the commercial answers yet, I don't.
So you've got a great idea. You're not sure how to monetize it at the moment.
Not yet.
I would have guessed that medical aids would be doing this, but clearly they're not doing it.
So Discovery have got an incredible app. They've got Health ID. And you can navigate through the Discovery apps and you can find your data and doctors also have access to that. And I think that one of the issues with Health ID is that if you are a doctor and you have 100 patients, only Discovery have got about 2.2 million people out of about 9.2 million who are insured. So 2 out of 9 will be with Discovery, which is not nothing, but a doctor doesn't want to log into 5 different systems. Mm. They want to log into 1 system. So I think that if we can aggregate that, I think that Discovery will get better service and doctors will use it more. But there are excellent systems. Netcare's CareOn is fantastic as well, but it exists within the Netcare system.
So you've gone through all these businesses and as you said, it's never a straight line. And now you're starting a business, doing a lot of work, and you're not sure how it's going to pay you, but you've got enough faith that something's going to come of it.
I do.
And I want to explore a little bit around the lessons that you've learned from all of these businesses. But we'll do that after the break.
Good.
The AltJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
I'm David Zeidel. You're listening to the AltJet Business Show, and we're on 101.9 High FM. And we're talking to Alan Sweden, who's a psychotherapist and turned businessman with a number of different friends in different businesses. And Alan's taken us through his whole life career of going through all these different businesses. And Alan, I want to find out from you. So somebody who is thinking of doing some kind of business, whenever you go into a business, you need, maybe you've got a great idea, you need funding for it. You need to find out, can you monetize it? Although in the case of Mammoth, you're not even sure of that. But if you were talking to somebody who hasn't done this before, the lessons that you've learned through your business career, what would those key lessons be?
I guess people need to know who they are in business. You can have a certain relationship. You can know who you are in a loving relationship. You can know what you like as a friend. You can know what you like in other circumstances. But people are not always very familiar with themselves when it comes to money and when it comes to business. And I think people have to be very honest with themselves about do I have appetite for risk? Do I like committees? Do I enjoy having partners? Can I provide the momentum that's required for a startup, or do I want to be involved in a business where the momentum is created for me? And people, I think, need to understand who they are, because I think that if you put the wrong person in a startup or you put the wrong person into a corporate, regardless of the skills, you're going to have the wrong fit. So that's I think, an important thing.
And if you don't know that, do you need to go see a psychotherapist to find out who you are? How do you know if you can take risks or not? How do you know if you can work with a committee? How do you know all the things that you've just spoken about?
Well, I mean, people can't see me, but I've got white hair. So it's taken me a while to work out exactly who I am. But I knew from when I was quite young that I needed a partner. I've always been aware of the things that I don't possess. And I've been extremely lucky in having, you know, just really incredible partners along the way with Alon Aptiaka, Alon Litz, and now with Alan and Lisa. And they are able to, with them, I'm much more than I am on my own. So that's, you know, that's important. So I love being someone's partner. I hate committees. So I want to be able to work with one or two people, make decisions and move forward. I don't want to. So I'm not a good corporate animal at all. But I mean, I think the things that I look for are, so the thing is, if people are interested in being an entrepreneur, they've got to find out what problem are they trying to solve. And, you know, is it a small problem? Like, there's no bakery in my neighborhood. And am I very comfortable with that being the opportunity just up the road? Yeah, my father once owned an ice cream shop called Carvel, which people who live in Glen Hazel might remember many, many years ago. But at the time, there wasn't actually a kosher ice cream shop in Glen Hazel. He saw the gap. It lasted a few years. I think it had some success, then it closed down. So it might be something that's what you want to do. You can own a hardware store. You can do that. Do you want to be a professional? Or do you actually want to solve a big problem? I mean, that's just absolutely just not for everybody. For me, that's something that I've learned about myself. I like solving big problems. But people need to understand, I guess, about themselves, like, you know, where do I fit in? Do I want to solve a big problem, or do I want to solve a small problem? Or do I want a lifestyle business, or do I want a business that's a legacy business? You know, what am I in this for? And people also, I guess, I mean, people need to be honest about what is it that you want to do. Do you want to be rich? If you want to be rich, okay. Own it. Mm. If you want to help people, then own that. But you kind of need to know who you are. Otherwise, you don't know what your values are.
And how can you tell what your risk propensity is? That you think that you can take risks, but then you can't. Is there a way of assessing for yourself beforehand, am I a risk taker or not? Or can I take limited risks?
I mean, I'll tell you how I find that out about myself. So when we had the opportunity to buy Crescent Clinic, for the first time in our lives, Lucy and I were out of debt. She had an aunt who had passed away and had left her parents some money, and her parents were incredibly kind people, and they gave us some of that, and it was pounds. And when you converted that into rands, for the first time in our lives, we had our daughter, and we were out of debt. And then we had this opportunity to buy into Crescent Clinic, and it meant going into more debt than I had ever been in. And that was the moment, I guess, for me. It was like, do I believe in this or don't I? And that's the moment when someone says to you, will you put money in? You'll know. Yes, I'll either put money in, or no, I just want to be in a job. And for me, that was the moment. I can say I had lots of privilege, but I didn't have any real financial buffer. So that's the thing, you know, are you prepared to risk something that's really going to keep you up at night or not?
And when you made that decision, was it like, yay, I've made the decision, or did you still have this feeling of anxiety around, have I made the right decision, until it started to work out?
I had anxiety for years and years and years and years. And I think, again, I'll just mention, you know, so Lucy would say to me, it's okay if it doesn't work out. You know, we can move into a smaller home and you can go back into practice and, you know, we'll be okay. And knowing that we would be okay, and that, you know, that was a big thing for me, really, it was. But I had anxiety. An entrepreneur lives with anxiety all the time.
So I think that's a crucial thing for people listening in, where they think, if I'm a risk taker, then I can take risks, but I don't feel it. You feel the risk, but you do it anyway.
But it's a rush.
Maybe you're addicted to the rush.
I'm addicted to the rush. I absolutely love it. But it's not for everyone.
Yeah. Wow, the insights that you've given us have been amazing. It's know who your customer is. It's know who you're servicing, it's working with others, it's being able to see the future, and in fact, know who you are, and so that you can take the risk if you're a risk taker, but avoid it if you're not. And partner with somebody you can work with, and you can work with a whole lot of different L's, and excuse the pun, and I'm known for making these puns, but I think tonight you've made an L of a difference.
Thanks very much.
So this has been the Orchard Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we've had this fascinating talk with Alan Sweden, the co-founder of October and a psychotherapist. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.